You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Dredd's Rebellion by Julian Lucas. Scott likes to say that if Ronald Reagan made him a communist, Malcolm X and Chairman Mao made him a reader. Taking pictures at punk shows and learning to develop film in the darkroom of his father, a photographer, Scott discovered a visual talent that carried him to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, SAIC. Though drawn to public art through the murals of Diego Rivera and Black Arts Movement painters like William Walker, Scott found an outlet for his burgeoning radicalism in performance art and installations. As a 24-year-old student, he exhibited What is the Proper Way to Display a U.S. Flag at SAIC, draping a 5-foot American flag across the floor under a photo montage about patriotism and protest. In order to answer the title question in a ledger, visitors had to decide whether or not to stand on the flag. Commenters filled more than 400 pages. But words were insufficient to contain the breadth and intensity of the reaction. While some Vietnam veterans supported the work, many others picketed, chanting, "The flag and the artist, hang them both high." Scott and his mother received death threats. A unanimous United States Senate proposed anti-desecration legislation, later invalidated by a Supreme Court decision to which Scott was party, with specific reference to the artist's work. The president, George H.W. Bush, offered a short review that the artist now features on his website. Disgraceful. For Scott, the hateful responses served a didactic purpose. The work aimed to offend, but aggrieved nationalists were not his audience. He was speaking to the casually patriotic, those reflexively attached, he believes, to an ideology they failed to scrutinize. What worthwhile values could America's sacred symbol represent if opening it to criticism elicited racial slurs and threats of lynching? The exhibition was also an expression of solidarity with victims of state power. At the time of the show, Chicago's South Side was being terrorized by John Burge, commander of a police precinct where hundreds of false confessions were extracted through torture. Defying a police department threat to bring felony charges against anyone who set foot on the flag, victims of law enforcement brutality wrote some of the most supportive comments. If black people had not been willing to offend, the artist told reporters, we'd still be slaves today. In the photos, two roads converge. This fall, costumed reenactors will retrace the route that rebel slaves took during the German Coast Uprising of 1811. The projected path of the two-day march will roughly follow the original. Scott's volunteers, possibly with spectators in tow, plan to continue on to New Orleans. And a map is pictured here. Also, costume drama. Reenactor Denise Frazier. Cloth samples for a reenactor's regalia. A contemporary sketch of a marcher's attire. William Kay's Seamstresses, St. Kitts, Caribbean, 1798. And role models. Reenactor Jana Chachper. Lebrus's costumes de different pays. Negres de Saint-Domingue, ses battants au bâton. Circa 1797. Reenactor Malcolm Suber. And these portraits are by David Halliday. When Scott decided to reenact a slave rebellion, he had Nat Turner and Denmark Vesey in mind. Like most Americans, he had never heard of the 1811 uprising that erupted on the young country's frontier. The rebellion united a multinational group of enslaved people from Louisiana, the French Caribbean, and West African polities like Asante and Congo against shared oppression. This motley yet determined force drove east along the Mississippi toward New Orleans, then a walled territorial capital where blacks outnumbered whites. Runaway Maroons and hostile Spaniards haunted the borderland bayous, and the French Creole citizenry distrusted their greenhorn American governor. Led by two Africans, Cook and Comana, and an enslaved overseer from Saint-Domingue named Charles Delonde, the insurgents toppled plantations like dominoes. As whites fled en masse to the capital, they left their land defenseless. It cannot be proved that this force planned to abolish slavery, as had their Haitian predecessors. But the historian Vincent Brown, a Harvard scholar who has written extensively on slave rebellions, told me it would be a dereliction of historical duty not to imagine their unrecorded aims. Next, photos, period pieces. A costume sketch for November's March. An illustration from Colonel Fry's Côte Occidentale d'Afrique. Examples of Senegalese dress by Auguste Racinet from Le Costume Historique. 19th century voodoo legend Marie Laveau by F. Schneider's painting. After a painting by G. Catlin. Armed planters and American dragoons massacred the rebels, driving those they didn't capture or kill into the swamps. 1 year later, Louisiana joined the Union, opening the Mississippi River Basin to a century of plantation slavery and genocidal conquest. By order of the governor, the rebels were tried and executed on the plantations they'd overthrown. Their decapitated heads were displayed on pikes along River Road. Scott and I drove this route, beginning where the revolt first struck in present-day La Place in St. John the Baptist Parish. In 1811, the area was a mosaic of sugar plantations, long, narrow properties with mansions fronting the Mississippi and fields that stretched back to the bayous. Near Lake Pontchartrain, now known as Cancer Alley, it is a patchwork of industrial towns known for poverty and pollution, where residents, many of whom are descendants of enslaved sugar workers, suffer from some of the highest rates of cancer in the country. When Scott first visited the area, he didn't know what to expect. The drive from New Orleans passes over picturesque wetlands, but the towns are hardly daguerreotypes of the gallant South. We passed refinery drums, mobile homes beached on cinder blocks, and gated subdivisions. Our first stop was the city's only tribute to the rebellion, a single phrase, "Major 1811 Slave Uprising Organized Here." On a plaque, commemorating the old woodland plantation not far from a Domino's Pizza. The few public reminders of the antebellum era take the form of tours at refurbished plantations. Visitors to estates like Destrehan, one of the plantations where the rebels were tried and executed, vicariously indulge in the sweet life of planter aristocrats. Destrehan does have a small exhibit acknowledging the uprising, arguably the most important event in the property's history, but it is housed in an outbuilding and omitted from the main tour. The focus is on period ambiance. The furniture, clothes, and intimate passions of lordly patriarchs, whom docents often refer to with avuncular affection. Mannequins, permanently engrossed in their domestic labors, are the most prominent representations of the enslaved. In 2015, domestic terrorist Dylan Roof took selfies with a similar display months before he shot 9 black congregants at the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. Just imagine going to Auschwitz and hearing about the commandant and his difficulties, Scott said as we passed the San Francisco plantation, now a tourist attraction in Garyville. Nobody would accept that. The big house sits squarely in the middle of an immense marathon refinery. San Francisco, like many of the area's extant plantations, was renovated by Big Oil, and today its website advertises availability for weddings. Imagine stepping back in time when sugarcane was king and money didn't matter. If plantation tours screen the past behind a cordon sanitaire, Scott hopes the reenactment's route will highlight the disquieting continuity between Louisiana's plantation past and its petrochemical present. Downriver from Laplace, we arrive in Norco, a company town largely developed by Royal Dutch Shell. In 1953, the oil giant displaced hundreds of black sharecroppers from their homes to clear the way for a refinery and a chemical plant. They were resettled on cheap land along the perimeter of the facility, a Louisiana mortar of docks, drums, and catalytic cracking towers that dwarfs the surrounding residential blocks. Where captive laborers once boiled sugarcane under the lash, contemporary residents of fence-line communities endure noxious chemical emissions, deadly explosions, periodically unbreathable air, and declining real estate prices. Surveying nearby houses and churches, Scott said that he'd like his work to communicate a message to residents. The rebels of 1811 would have been fighting for people like you. Some of them, Scott hopes, will join him. Slave rebellion reenactment is not only an artwork, but an experiment in social choreography. He envisions the march wending through work sites and residential neighborhoods like a parade, with onlookers invited to join in the style of a New Orleans second line. Many of the 1811 rebels were strangers, forced to organize in secret. Emulating their approach, Scott isn't specifically enlisting actors or hobbyists for his army of the enslaved, though he intends to pay every participant an honorarium. Instead, he has launched a clandestine recruitment process mirroring the original. His core cadre includes professors, poets, arts workers, and student activists. They will, in turn, canvass others. building a network that will fully assemble for the first time only a few weeks before the event. As he explained, the less it is a Dred Scott project, the better. His ideal spectator is a commuter glimpsing the marchers from a car and thinking, these people look like they're getting free. Others, no doubt, will see something more provoking, black people with weapons. The reenactment will take place in a state where the majority of white voters in the 1990s supported former Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke in his bids to become senator and governor. It will end in a city where in 2016, arsonists firebombed the Lamborghini of a contractor hired to remove Confederate statues. Scott is quick to say that his march is a performance, not a protest. But he knows that in a post-Charlottesville America, he cannot assume that every spectator will appreciate the difference. The artist stressed that he is taking precautions to ensure the safety of participants, working to secure police protection and official permits from the parishes the reenactors will pass through. There will be animal-drawn wagons for weary marchers, medical staff standing by, and cameras following the procession. Before the event, town hall outreach sessions will allow River Parish residents to voice objections. Scott is confident that the dangers can be minimized. Nevertheless, we seem to live in a nation increasingly unable to discern the line between representation and reality. A country where people saw Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old black boy, playing with a toy gun in Cleveland, and shot him to death. Can it be trusted to let hundreds of black marchers play act one of the most deep-seated nightmares of the American imagination? I'm more concerned if we don't do this than if we do, Scott told me. Artwork is not going to prevent another Tamir Rice. But without art and activism, talking about freedom and emancipation from white supremacy, the status quo that is grinding up people's lives will continue. DeLon's rebels came from a myriad of African nations. Scott's represent a similar diversity of organizations in New Orleans arts, activist, and academic communities. I met several of them for a costume fitting at Antenna, a nonprofit gallery and art space on St. Claude Avenue in the Bywater that is helping to sponsor the reenactment. The gathering had the casually energized atmosphere of a campaign office. Scott circled the room taking pictures, wearing an 1811 New Orleans team tee designed for the project's Kickstarter campaign. The bulk of the budget will be supplied by grants from philanthropic nonprofits, including the Open Society Foundations, the MAP Fund, Via Art Fund, and A Blade of Grass. Someone remarked that the outfits researched by Scott's costumers at the nonprofit Rick Rack NOLA seemed too upmarket for the enslaved. Should they even be wearing shoes? Scott demurred. Enslaved people, he said, were the country's most valuable asset class. If you drive a Mercedes, you're not going to ruin its treads. Besides, he added for good measure, I'm sure they picked up some nice swag at the plantations they pillaged. Denise Frazier, a Tulane music scholar and assistant director of the New Orleans Center for the Gulf South, posed with a machete and a red head wrap and blue-striped chintz dress. The Rebellion's community outreach director, Malcolm Suber, a veteran academic, labor activist, and a national figure in the Take 'em Down NOLA campaign against monuments to slaveholders and segregationists, stood like Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man for the seamstress. In another corner of the room sat Imani Jacqueline Brown, at the time director of programs at Antenna. She compared Scott's rebellion to a spark in the wind setting little fires across the city. All year long, sewing circles have been finishing costumes. Volunteers have included everyone from retired nurses to undergraduates at Xavier University of Louisiana, where Ron Bechet, an artist and professor, is teaching a course on the uprising. One of the first people Scott sought out in the city was Leon Waters, a local historian, docent, and activist, who is also something like the chief archivist of the 1811 revolt. A New Orleans native and firebrand community advocate, Waters, in 1996, helped research and publish On to New Orleans, the first book on the uprising. He also established Hidden History, an alternative tour company that he conceived after encountering and picketing a slave exchange restaurant in the French Quarter, where patrons ate their gumbo under whips and chains. Sick of the opportunists who treat black history as a stolen commodity, Waters began leading tours on the rebellion and organizing commemorative annual marches in public schools. Those processions stopped after Hurricane Katrina, but Waters hopes that Scott's reenactment might revive interest. It would be a bright spot in what Waters considers a shameful record of public history in New Orleans, marred by romanticism and distortion. "We want a much more scientific story," he told me, "a story about our resistance, and a story that we are still resisting oppression today." In many ways, the Black American story, and slavery in particular, has never been more visible. A wave of films, books, television shows, prominent artworks, and ever grander public institutions testify to a heritage regained. Maryland's 125-mile Harriet Tubman Scenic Byway, Montgomery, Alabama's National Memorial for Peace and Justice, and a runaway trend of fugitive slave novels, from Colson Whitehead's award-winning The Underground Railroad, soon to be adapted for television by Barry Jenkins, to Ta-Nehisi Coates' The Water Dancer, and Isai Edigwine's Man Booker Prize-nominated Washington Black. Slavery remembrance has swelled to the dimensions of a civic religion. In the ziggurat-like National Museum of African American History and Culture, iron ballast bars from slave ships are enshrined like fragments of the true cross, while the recently discovered wreck of the Clotilda, America's last slave ship, has prompted hopes for an Africatown, Alabama, tourist site on the order of colonial Jamestown. Are these stirrings of a consequential reckoning or empty remnants of the Obama era's Pyrrhic cultural victory? All the commemoration in the world won't stop police shootings, pay reparations for slavery, or free today's fugitive families from ICE detention. Symbolic change is not only untethered from lasting political power, but evanescent in itself, like the Harriet Tubman $20 bill recently postponed by the Trump Treasury. If she did appear on This America's Currency, who's to say it wouldn't be meaningless? After all, what use is a black Smithsonian on the National Mall with a white nationalist in the Oval Office? There is, of course, a chancy alchemy by which cultural recognition really can change political reality. In June, when a congressional committee met to discuss reparations for slavery, one witness was Coates, whose 2014 essay, The Case for Reparations, brought the question into the political mainstream. The bill they considered cited not only scholarship, but popular culture markers as evidence of the widely felt need to make amends. Dred Scott's Slave Rebellion reenactment embodies a similar impulse, but the change it envisions is less concerned with society's top-down moral repair than its radical reconstitution. A chimerical combination of artwork, community organizing, and protest, it resurrects the past to further egalitarian change in the present. What's singular is that it is neither a solemn penance for American slavery nor a premature commemoration of achieved racial justice. Instead, Scott asks us to look upon an army of the enslaved that marched for freedom against the United States and celebrate their victory. What else could we imagine if we could imagine that? Future Perfect, with photographs by Cass Bird, styled by Samira Nasser. An Adventure on the Streets of Lower Manhattan, with Mackenzie Davis, Hollywood's go-to apocalyptic muse in the season's most cutting-edge couture, by Sonia Soraya. Opening photos show her wearing a dress by Givenchy Haute Couture, sandals by Giuseppe Zanotti, clothing and earrings by Armani Privé, hat by Eric Javits. Mackenzie Davis is absolutely worried about the rise of the machines. "Yes," she says, when I ask if, like her character Grace, in the upcoming Terminator Dark Fate, she is stressed out about artificial intelligence imminently exterminating humankind. She is emphatic, but incredulous, as if she can't believe I had to ask. Davis had spent the day before voguing around Lower Manhattan in this season's most desirable couture. It threatened to thunderstorm the whole time, and finally did overnight, drenching the terrace where we're sitting on a Tuesday morning. There's a nip in the air, so Davis is wearing a hotel-provided bathrobe. She brought one for me, too. She shows me her two necklaces, one from her sister that reads Kin, short for Mackenzie, and an 1880s $10 coin on a long chain, nicked from her boyfriend for the trip. "He's like old-school American," says the Vancouver, British Columbia native, who moved to the U.S. to study acting after university. "It really reminds me of that Russian doll coin that she wears." Davis hates having her picture taken, but working with a female photographer made this less exacting. "I've done a few shoots recently that are just standing still, and having the male photographer be like, 'Open your mouth.'" She thrust out a shoulder, pretending to pose, but her voice keeps the photographer's nasal insistence. "Open your mouth. Okay, good. Chin down. Open your mouth." She unfolds again, and the scene is over. But her irritation isn't, even if it's couched in laughter. "Just let me keep my mouth closed, you know?" Anyway, the machines. She's been worrying about AirPods lately, that the earbuds will just become smaller until they're a cochlear implant or a microchip. She's animated, talking through the scenarios, and then you'll just get cables. She pauses, searching, and then her portent of doom comes out with laughter attached. "Injected in your head. You'll just get cables injected in your head." Winsome but bleak, that's Mackenzie Davis. Over the course of her short career, dystopia has become an intimate part of Davis's life. Before Terminator, there was Blade Runner 2049, where she played a hard-boiled sex worker in future Los Angeles. Before that, there was her breakout in Black Mirror's 2016 episode San Junipero, in which Davis and Gugu Mbatha-Raw played digital avatars falling in love in a spare near future. And before even that was Davis's turn as brilliant punk programmer Cameron Howe in AMC's Halt and Catch Fire. The series took place in the 1980s, but commented on our current era of tech overlords while steeped in new wave hacker paranoia. So the future but past has been where Davis thrives. She acknowledges the trend, though she says it seems far-fetched that casting directors would think of her while wondering to themselves who might fit that particularly narrow yet vague rubric. "It looks like I have a real focus and interest in the 80s, and I imagine that if I unpacked the political ideas and cultural shifts that were going on, maybe that's true. There's a reason why I'm attracted to that, she says. But I mean, who doesn't want to be in Blade Runner? Whatever the case, it is a niche with staying power in today's Hollywood, where intellectual property from the 80s still holds sway. Davis, a millennial, was born in the back half of the decade. But Hollywood keeps sending her back, or forward, to dark visions of the future as originally seen from the 1980s, anyway, and frequently, insistently, as a sensitive, vulnerable, defiant oracle, truth-telling to the other characters, the audience, or anyone else who will listen. Watching her in person and on screen, it's not hard to see why. Slim, tall, and especially when her hair's cut short, a little androgynous. Davis looks like the future, especially in contrast to the polyester and poofy hair of the 80s. When she's impassioned, conviction radiates from her, even as her wide eyes offer windows into her fears. She often looks like a woman who has seen too much, and her face is struggling to hold it all in. But something drives her to keep going, too. If Davis showed up on your doorstep one day, holding a weapon and talking about Judgment Day, you'd believe her. Terminator Dark Fate seeks to revive the franchise that began in 1984 with James Cameron and Gail Ann Hurd's apocalyptic romance, The Terminator, a seminal piece of 80s action that Cameron conjured after a vision of a metal skeleton wreathed in flames came to him during a literal fever dream. The series peaked in 1991 with the R-rated mega-hit Terminator 2 Judgment Day, and then fell off into a strange twilight of spin-offs and timelines, culminating in 2015's ill-liked Terminator Genesis. In 2017, Cameron retook creative control of the franchise as writer and producer. Directed by Tim Miller, Dark Fate reunites Cameron, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Linda Hamilton for a film that is in the same timeline as the original two. Except, only kind of, because at the end of Terminator 2, Hamilton's Sarah Connor changed the future. The movie calls back to the potent core of the Terminator universe, humanity's fight to survive, and the devastating technology that aims to annihilate it. The franchise has always pulsed with blood and chrome machismo, but the story's heart is a gooey, time-traveling romance. In a return to the series' feminist roots, Dark Fate's humans are all women. And Grace is the first to be sent back in time in Terminator history. She's there to save a new character named Donnie Ramos, played by Natalia Reyes. In the trailer's big fist pump moment, Connor shows up, guns blazing, to rescue them from the new two-bodied Rev-9, played by Gabriel Luna. There were beautiful times shooting it where I was like, is this an Andrea Arnold movie? Davis says. This really American Honey-esque road movie of these three women traveling across great distances and learning about each other. I know that's not the pitch I'm supposed to use for Terminator, but it's what really appealed to me and what's so special about the first two. Grace is efficient, Davis says, laughing. Focused. She's not like the comic relief. Though she's been enhanced, she's completely human, Davis says. I'm sure everyone's going to love this analogy, but her cybernetic alterations, it's like having a boob job or something. This is Davis's first foray into action, and she was unaccustomed to the training and physical toll of a day on set. acting in short burst. You're just running somewhere and shouting a line threw off her sense of when a scene was working. She has a newfound appreciation for action heroes. Bruce Willis is a genius, she says. As a child, Davis liked theater for the attention and the intimacy of a small group that sometimes got free pizza after school. Her parents, Lottie and John, who founded a hair care company out of their basement a couple of years after she was born, supported her dream to act, insisting only that she get a college education first. I've had a very easy road, Davis says. As she grew as a performer, her focus shifted inward. In a very selfish way, Davis says, I just really like feeling emotion. There were a few longer scenes in Terminator Dark Fate, and Davis spent the shoot anticipating them. Oh my God, we're going to talk in a hotel room all day long. I cannot wait. The Terminator movies are always trying to outrun human history, human innovation in the form of artificial intelligence, robotics, and Skynet. And it hasn't escaped Davis that 2019 is just a decade before the franchise's post-apocalyptic future, where beleaguered humans battle robots in a smoking nuclear wasteland. We keep exploring the same themes over and over and over again endlessly, Davis says. She loves science fiction, especially now that she's worked so much in the genre. But she wishes people engaged with its ideas a little more. It's so presumptuous and stupid that I want people to view movies as real cautionary tales, Davis adds. But it is weird that we get so much entertainment out of these near-future disaster movies and then don't learn anything. She's cynical about humanity's ability to change, but she sees an upside to it, too. As a woman in the film industry, she's made to constantly worry about her shelf life. We talk about other women in entertainment, like Hamilton, such a queen, Davis says, who made headlines at Comic-Con for refusing to say some of Sarah Connor's scripted lines in Dark Fate. And Judy Dench, who this spring told an interviewer, I take every job because I fear it will be my last. Davis has been mulling over what comes next for her, wondering if she needs to strike while the iron is hot. Then she gets some perspective. What does it matter? She says. The world is going to end in like 50 effing years. Why don't you just go have fun and don't worry about doing this correctly? Davis has wound herself up again, and for a moment she's Grace, telling the present something it does not really want to hear. Stricken by knowledge that is almost too difficult to bear. And then she settles down, and the future girl slips behind her facade, where she looks and acts just like everyone else. But I do care, she finishes simply. I don't know how to not care. Goodbye, Mr. Sunshine, by Bethany McLean. Elon Musk promised that his $5 billion gamble on solar energy would revolutionize the world. Instead, it could bring down Tesla. Opening photo illustration by Justin Patrick Long. Showing Elon Musk with many of his technological advances and factories around him. It was a Saturday night last March in Buffalo, and Dennis Scott was sitting at home. A stocky veteran with salt and pepper hair and a close-cropped beard, Scott had been laid off from Tesla's factory in Buffalo 2 months earlier as part of a global reduction in the company's workforce. Since then, he had taken to sending Elon Musk emails and point-blank tweets describing the pain the layoffs were causing. 10 days after Scott was let go, Musk had tweeted a goofy picture of himself posing with what looked like a machine gun. Scott retweeted the image and called Musk a clown. "If I were CEO and someone told me my company wasn't working right," he explains, "I wouldn't be clowning around. I've got people counting on me for their livelihood." Now, around 10 p.m., his phone rang. The call was from an unmarked number. Scott answered. "It's the clown," the person at the other end informed him. Scott, unfazed, figured that Musk must have gotten his number from the company. For the next 20 minutes, he recalls, he and his former employer had a civil conversation. "When are you going to fix your company?" Scott asked. Musk was pleasant, but offered no specifics about the Buffalo plant. Scott continued to ask frank questions. "You took $750 million from New York," he told Musk, referring to the taxpayer money that the state handed Tesla as part of its Buffalo Billion program to revitalize upstate New York. "You gave us hope that you were going to do something." Musk's responses left Scott unimpressed. "Musk is a nice guy when you talk to him," he says. "But I think he's full of shit. He'll tell you whatever you want to hear." In public, Musk doesn't talk much about Tesla's factory in Buffalo, a place he once, in better times, dubbed Gigafactory 2. Gigafactory 1, of course, is Tesla's much-hyped, futuristic electric car plant outside Reno. Gigafactory 2, which is shrouded in silence and secrets, was a controversial side venture, a high-stakes move to dominate America's growing market for solar energy. Tesla bought the factory's main tenant, SolarCity, for almost $5 billion in 2016. The plan, in true Muskian hyperbole, was to turn the plant in Buffalo into what was billed as the largest manufacturing facility of its kind in the Western Hemisphere. SolarCity would build 10,000 solar panels per day and install them on homes and businesses across the country. In the process, it would create 5,000 jobs in an area that very much needed them. "This is one of the poorest cities in the country," Scott says. "You get a big company here, and it's a big deal." From the outside, the sheer scale of the Buffalo plant sparkles with promise. At 1.2 million square feet, it stands at the point where the Buffalo River bends through the city. The building is gleaming white, as if to signify its freshness amid a landscape of abandoned grain elevators and sprawling, desolate steel mills. The area around the factory is hardscrabble working class. Until SolarCity was built, People only drove through it when the fierce wind off Lake Erie shut down the highway that residents take from the southern suburbs to downtown. Now three flags fly in front of the factory, those of the United States, New York State, and Tesla. But 3 years after Tesla bought Solar City, there are serious doubts as to whether the plant will ever fulfill its promises. The website Clean Technica, which is mostly supportive of Musk, calls Solar City a disaster waiting to happen. A potentially costly lawsuit alleges that Tesla acquired Solar City at the expense of its own shareholders, and former employees want to know what happened to the massive subsidy Tesla received. New York State taxpayers deserved more from a $750 million investment, a laid-off employee named Dale Witherell wrote to Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. Tesla has done a tremendous job providing smoke and mirrors and empty promises to the area. The controversy over Solar City, which has dovetailed with questions about Musk's mountain of debt and profit shortfalls, offers a window into the mindset of America's most outlandish and unpredictable CEO. Musk believers argue that the details of his ventures don't matter. It's the grand vision that counts. The guy has a will to make stuff happen that is extraordinary, says someone who worked closely with Musk. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.